Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along. For the third year in a row, the Sparrow Medical Group's Volunteers of America Clinic will participate in the Capital Area Stand Down for Homeless Veterans. This happens today, 10 a.m. till 3 at Adato Riverfront Park, downtown Lansing. Sparrow caregivers working at a table set up in a tent will perform blood pressure checks. They'll distribute kits containing basic needs like hand sanitizer and bandages and perform general outreach. Sparrow's VOA clinic serves the local homeless and near homeless population, both veterans and non-veterans, at its offices on North Larch Street. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. A Lansing mother is marking a sad anniversary today. 4 years ago, Dominique Artister was gunned down in the driveway of his South Lansing home. His murder remains unsolved. Artister's mother, Monica Blackwell, wants answers. She has her suspicions about who is responsible for her son's death on May 25, 2012. But with little information to go on, the Dominique Artister case has grown cold. More than 60 homicides have gone unsolved in Lansing since the mid-1960s. The reasons are complex and difficult to pinpoint, but what's clear is that each act of violence that ends a life carries a lifetime of pain for the victim's loved ones left behind. Current State's Kevin Lavery has more.
Monica Blackwell's eyes soften a bit when she talks about her oldest son, Dominique Artister. She uses words like amazing, unique, and a protector. Blackwell says if you were lucky enough to find a place in Dominique's heart, you knew it.
He had tons and tons of energy from the time he was born till when he left here. He was just a special person. His smile would just brighten up a room.
Blackwell recalls a funny yet proud moment from Dominique's early life, something that reveals a flicker of his character.
He was in kindergarten and he felt like he was too old for mom to walk him to the bus stop. So he was like, you don't have to walk. It was just up the street. You don't have to walk with me, and you don't have to come and meet me. So I would stand and watch out the window and make sure that he made it. And one day he was like, see, I'm okay. That made me proud. And I knew then that he would be able to protect himself or whatever. You know, he was just independent like that.
In May 2012, Dominique Artister was a 29-year-old father of three. By then, he had already had two close brushes with death. The first time was that February, when he was shot in the foot at a convenience store. Then in May, Dominique was fired upon at a South Lansing gas station. A week later, he had one last late-night talk with his mother.
I had spoke with him about 11:45 that night. He stopped by. And then he said he was going to meet somebody. I can't really remember. That was the last time I spoke with him, and he told me he'll see me tomorrow and that he was ready to cook his own Memorial Day dinner for the first time. And I told him, okay, be safe. And then that call came, and it was his girlfriend, just the scream. I knew that it was bad. She couldn't give me any details because I think she was too distraught. I had no clue then where he was shot at, what part of his body. I just knew that she said he wasn't responding and there was a lot of blood.
Monica Blackwell knows the what, and she even believes she knows who. But 4 years after his death, Dominique Artister's case remains unsolved. And ever since, his mother has struggled with the biggest question of all.
Why is what I ask all the time? Unfortunately, I haven't been able to ask those that are responsible, because I know in my heart it's a group of people. Of course, all of them can't pull a trigger at once, but I would love to know why. I would really love to know why.
Monica isn't alone in her search for resolution. Lansing has some 65 unsolved homicides in its files dating back to the 1960s. Rena Risper is a journalist, community activist, and founder of the New Citizens Press Community Action Network. She advocates for people like Monica Blackwell, whose heartaches stay long after the headlines fade.
You know, in the media, it's always, if it bleeds, it reads. On the other side of that, someone is still bleeding. Someone is still crying every single day. When we talk about closure, the children don't have closure. The parents don't have closure. Closure is just kind of a word. And it closes and it opens, it closes, and it opens. It opens every time a birthday comes, a wedding, a birth of another child in the family. So it's about being there for people.
Risper says the world of a murder victim's family revolves around the investigation. They depend on law enforcement to find answers, and that takes time, especially if the trail goes cold. Detective Lee McAllister leads the Lansing Police Department's cold case units.
I think unit is a little bit broad because it's just me. So, you know, it's a cold case office, I guess.
The key to an investigation's success, says McAllister, is cooperation. Police rely on families and witnesses, if there are any, to be willing to help.
If we don't get that cooperation, then obviously it makes our job a lot harder.
How do you try initially to gain that trust, to build that type of trust? Are there just certain people for whom trust of authority is just difficult inherently?
Absolutely. There are people that no matter what we do or say, will not. They're not going to trust us. They're not going to talk with us just because that's, you know, that may be the way they were raised. That may be the way they've come to think over dealings with law enforcement in the past. And, you know, I'm not going to change that in a half hour to an hour interview or something to that effect. We take, you know, the officers that I work with, the detectives that I work with, we take our street credentials very seriously. If we make someone a promise, we keep that promise so that we have a reputation on the streets of Lansing of, hey, you know, I've dealt with Detective McAllister in the past. He treated me fairly. And, you know, I'm going, you know, hopefully we'll get the response where they're going to help me or help another officer who they've gained trust from. Because without that reputation, you're going to be dead in the water. Because without the assistance from the community, a lot of these cases won't have anywhere to go.
We're talking with Officer Lee McAllister, who's a detective with the Lansing Police Department. When a case does sit on a shelf for various reasons, and it's there a long time, years sometimes, what do you have to do as a police officer to keep it a priority?
The first thing we do with any case that's been on the shelf for a while is look through the case, who are the people that we had names of at that time, track them down, and see if something new has come to light to them, or if their opinions of what happened have changed, and that's always the first place to start.
McAllister says as time passes, family members sometimes pick up tidbits of information about their loved one's murder. Not all of it is reliable. Monica Blackwell has heard the rumors about Dominique's death.
I hear that it was a a hit. That people were paid to do it. I've heard that it was because they were jealous, which my son had nothing. He wasn't even employed at the time. He was collecting unemployment. And I don't know what they would be jealous of. I've heard that it was multiple people in the vehicle that the neighbor saw. Basically, I just heard that it was just, they just wanted him out of the way because they felt like he might cause them a problem because they kept going for people in the family. My son, Dominique, didn't hang around these people. When he tried to intervene, that's when I think he got drawn in. He tried to tell them to let it go. Everybody agreed, but obviously he's not here, so they didn't let it go. Those are the kind of things that I hear. The same names from day one popped up, the same ones. It has not changed. So that's why I say it's a group of people.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, some of the names I am very familiar with, people that have been at my house.
Again, Lansing Detective Lee McAllister.
You know, it's one thing for us to hear something and, you know, and know something. You know, I may know who committed a homicide, but that's not good enough. In our country, obviously, we have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt in the court. And to do that, we have to have people come forward and tell their story. And it's got to be their story. We can't hear it third hand from the, you know, the lady down the street.
Blackwell says she's not satisfied with the investigation into her son's death, which is actually being led by another Lansing police officer. She wants to see more pressure put upon those whom the police may identify as potential suspects.
I personally think that even though the community is not like running to the police and saying, hey, so-and-so was here and so-and-so said that. I still think that some of the information that is relayed to them, whether it came third party or not, the police should lean on those suspects or potential suspects and let them know, we're watching you. I think if they know that they're being watched and not getting away with murder, then I think they'll slip up in other things. You know, something else will come up, or maybe they'll start talking and then they can move forward. It's hard living in Lansing, knowing these people are there and knowing they're not being arrested. They're just walking around freely, enjoying life.
The longer a case stays cold, the more the victim's family craves communication. But for the police, even the process of checking in can be delicate. Again, Lansing Detective Lee McAllister.
I generally leave that up to the family. When I make my first contact, they have my phone number, they have my email address, and I encourage them to call me at any time or send me a message, and I will respond as quickly as I can. There are a few cases where I've went out to visit at their request. I'm cautious of calling and just, you know, checking in or chatting, because, you know, some people I don't want to, you know, rip open a wound that maybe has kind of been smoothed over with time. And I mean, it never really gets closed until, you know, their loved one has some justice. But I'm cautious of, you know, just reaching out blindly to family members.
Dr. David Carter is a professor of criminology at Michigan State University and a former Kansas City police officer. He's recently published a study that examined how 7 American cities and counties successfully cleared their homicide caseload. Carter says police investigators in Richmond, Virginia, took a proactive approach by essentially adopting the families with whom they worked.
They would spend a lot of time with them. They would talk with them. They'd keep them up to date on the investigation. And this historically isn't done by homicide investigators. It's done by frequently done by victim witness advocates, which are typically, although not exclusively, typically in the prosecutor's office. So we asked them, why did they do this? And there are 2 key reasons came out. One, it was the right thing to do. But the other thing was that they found as doing this was, as they would talk to family members, they would often learn information that could help them in their investigation. And importantly, it wasn't because the family members were hiding information. They just didn't know it. I mean, they just didn't know this might help in an investigation. That never occurred to them. So for both of those reasons, and they found this to, and consequently, it also got greater support for the police by doing this, by keeping the family involved.
Rena Risper, the community activist, believes the Lansing Police Department could reduce its cold case backlog through more partnerships.
One person is not enough. There's, in my mind, all kinds of opportunities to collaborate with Michigan State University, to collaborate with the law schools, Michigan State University Law School, Thomas M. Cooley Law School. There's so many opportunities to collaborate. Why don't we just get some retired police officers to set up some type of system where they assist with unsolved cases here in Lansing? Because there are quite a few.
But until such time as Lansing allocates more resources, Detective Lee McAllister continues setting goals for his one-man department.
I want to continue to get charges against people that have committed these unsolved cases. I'd like to set a goal for myself to get, one a year. I think that's a realistic goal, and we strive to do that. We just completed one last year. We had a charge and a conviction of a case that had went almost 4 years before it was, closed. And we got that closure, we got the conviction, and we move on to the next one. And as we keep going on, hopefully we can build this unit into something more than it is now, more than just the one detective. Maybe we can build it into something more where we become a little bit more active and even more successful.
For now, though, Monica Blackwell is trying to continue on with her life. The frustration in her voice is obvious, especially this week, as she marks 4 years since she lost her oldest child.
As the years go by, I'm like, so they're probably not looking anymore. They're probably not even thinking about it. But I just feel like Lansing's too small to have 60-plus unsolved murders, and really no one is really addressing it. Yes, McAllister is assigned to it, but he's also still on regular duty. So it's not getting the attention it needs. Just not for my son, for all of them. We need more.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up shortly on Current State, the mission of Epiphany Now is to create a revolution of positive experiences through acts of kindness. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with Epiphany Now's founder, Bob Hoffman, and two young people the group is thanking for passing kindness forward. That and more on the way on Current State. They've become increasingly commonplace in Michigan cities. Here in Lansing, Jackson, and elsewhere, once endangered peregrine falcons nest and breed high in city buildings. In downtown Jackson, the birds nest in a space up in the Tower Building. The Jackson County website offers an opportunity for people to view these birds on its 3-megapixel digital camera. Steve Shotwell knows all about these birds for two reasons. Steve is chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. He also owns and operates a business in downtown Jackson, just across the street from the Tower Building, and he joins me now. Mr. Shotwell, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
How long have peregrines been nesting in the Tower Building?
We can confirm nesting since 2008.
And how many young falcons have been born there? Is that known?
Yes, it is. We've had 21 fledged, and then this year's birth, and at the moment we have 3 chicks up there right now, and the babies themselves, so this will be 24.
How many young per year typically hatch and survive?
Well, in Jackson, we typically have between 3 and 5. We've had up to 5 hatch, but we've always fledged, it seems, between 3 and 4, which is a little better than the national average.
And how does it work in the nesting area itself here? Do the young go off and find their own homes, or does the I understand the DNR gets involved with the chicks. Why don't we start there? What do they do?
Well, the DNR will come in here sometime between the 1st of June and Father's Day weekend, and they will band the birds, they will check their eyes, they will get blood samples and DNA information on the birds so they can keep track of them, and then they band the birds, and that information is then sent to Cornell University as well as kept here with our Michigan DNR to track the birds.
But where do those young birds go? Do they fly off and make their own nests or what?
Typically, the peregrine falcon will migrate to in the south, somewhere along the Gulf Coast, typically spend its first 1 or 2 years down there, and then come back to the Midwest and nest. Our pair, Chaitin and Big Red, one is from Ohio and one's from Minnesota. So they paired up, obviously, down south and came up and explored the different nesting areas.
Hmm.
And Big Red came from a large family herself. She was in a clutch of 6 babies, and her mother would typically have between 5 and 7 eggs, and she's had typically between 4 and 6 eggs.
Here in Lansing, we've got peregrines nesting on a smokestack at the local utility here, the Lansing Board of Water and Light, and also in the Bogie Tower, a 23-story building downtown. Tell us, where exactly do the birds nest in the Tower Building?
They nest on what would be the southeastern corner of the Tower Building, and we have 4 large parapets that surround the top of it, which put a wall or a border. So our chicks are not at risk of blowing out or being knocked out by storms. A lot of times what happens is when they're nesting in the boxes and in those areas, it can be difficult for the chicks to fledge all the way because they don't have a big enough area to stretch their wings and that type of activity, which is needed for the birds.
Steve Shotwell is chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. He also owns and operates a business in downtown Lansing, not far from the Tower Building, where since about 2008 or so, peregrine falcons have nested and bred. Describe a peregrine for us, Steve. What is most notable about these birds?
Well, these are a large bird. They're the second largest predatory bird. And they're what we call a pinnacle predator, which means that they're at the top of the food chain. And typically a peregrine will be around 12 to 14 inches tall, and the female is larger than the male, and the nesting area is selected typically from where they nested as a child. Some of the information and studies on the peregrines have shown that if you nested on a building, your first choice is to nest on a building yourself if you were born on a building. So it's a very interesting program. Mm.
I think some number of people know that peregrines can dive at a very high rate of speed. Tell us about that.
Well, they are the fastest North American animal. They will dive at they've been clocked at diving at over 180 miles an hour. And this has been shown, you can see this quite often. You know, you'll be walking around downtown and all of a sudden feathers will start fluttering down and you'll realize that a collision had occurred somewhere above you. And so it makes for interesting afternoons in downtown. There's a lot of nice cafes you can sit at and watch the birds fly in and out. And so, yeah, it makes for a good experience.
And I know you can do the same thing in downtown Lansing here,
yes.
Certainly at the Bogie Building, for one. We've got a clip of a peregrine, and then actually what you'll hear is a single peregrine falcon and then a pair of peregrines. Let's have a listen. See, one final question here. Is the intention here for the peregrines to live in the tower building indefinitely?
Yeah, it's a two-stage program. Also, we've tied it in with our strategic plan of education, and we've made the live feed available in the classrooms in Jackson County. And I've had the opportunity this past 2 weeks ago to give a presentation to the science class at East Jackson High School, where the kids were able to actually see the live footage and witness Big Red feeding the children. So that was part of our whole idea, was to share the experience with the youth of Jackson County and get a better picture of what nature is all about.
You can get a great angle on these birds on the Jackson County website, a 3-megapixel digital camera. I recommend it for our listeners who are interested in birds. We've been talking about downtown Jackson's nesting peregrine falcons with Steve Shotwell, a downtown Jackson business owner and chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much, and enjoy your day.
And to learn more about the bigger picture involving peregrine falcons here in Michigan, let's turn to Karen Cleveland. Karen is a bird biologist for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Good morning.
How many Michigan cities have peregrines nesting in them today? Do you know?
Well, it's kind of interesting because we have some cities that have multiple nest sites in them, but statewide we had 33 active nests last year, and only about a half dozen of those were on natural sites. The rest were all on man-made locations, and that ranged all the way from Houghton up in the UP down to Monroe down in the southern Lower Peninsula.
Now, I know DNR placed some peregrines in city skyscrapers in the mid-80s. As these birds die off, does DNR have to restock these spaces, or do other birds just move in and take them over?
We actually did the last releases of peregrine falcons on sites back in 1992. So all the birds that you're seeing out on the landscape right now, those are, for the most part, wild hatched birds. In Canada, they are still doing some of these bird releases going on in some locations as they're trying to get birds back. But the rest of these birds are all hatched in the wild from somewhere in the Midwest, could be Ontario even.
What cities will a peregrine falcon nest?
Well, their natural habitat is actually to be nesting on cliff ledges. And so in certain parts of the country, you still see a lot of that kind of activity going on. In Michigan, historically, most of that activity was going on in the UP, a lot of it along the lake shores. And we do actually have some of that that's happening again in Michigan now, which is kind of exciting.
I know peregrines all but disappeared 40 or 50 years ago due to DDT and PCBs. How firmly reestablished is the peregrine falcon in Michigan today?
Well, to kind of put it in perspective, what we think we had for numbers in pre-settlement times was probably in the neighborhood of about 10 to 15 pairs. And again, these are the natural cliff sites, which we don't have a lot of. Right now, we had 33 nesting pairs last year in Michigan. Again, the bulk of them are on these man-made sites that weren't available before we came and settled the state and built these wonderful man-made cliffs for them. But we're doing really well, and a lot of the building managers that have peregrines really love that the birds are there and are really taking care of a lot of pigeon problems for them.
So, well, you anticipated my next question. I was going to ask you what they feed on. They feed on pigeons?
Well, they basically feed on lots of birds. One of their nicknames is duck hawk because they're actually known for taking waterfowl on the wing. Basically anything that's a mallard or a merganser size or smaller, they will actually try to take from the air. And what's kind of exciting is you would think that they would dive and then grab with their talons. And they've done some slow motion photography and discovered that when they come out of the dive, they actually fist their feet and they slam into those birds with those two fists at 200 plus miles an hour, and it stuns the bird out of the sky, at which point they can go and collect it, which is kind of cool to see.
Wow. And now we've heard from Steve Shotwell, DNR is banning a lot of these birds in just the coming weeks, which sounds death-defying enough. How do your folks access these birds?
Well, some of the sites we can't actually access. There's not a safe way to do it. But we've got staff actually this morning that are going to be at the Eckert Power Plant here in Lansing. So if folks are watching the webcam for Eckert, you can actually watch when our staff go out to collect them. They'll be having safety harnesses on as they go out to take those chicks out of the nest box. They'll be in Jackson tomorrow wearing lots of hard hats. The female in Jackson is very defensive about her young. She's drawn blood, and we used a towel one year to try to scare her off by flapping the towel, and she stole the towel from our band. So she's a pretty aggressive mother, and we like to see that.
And remind us what is learned exactly from banding these birds.
Well, we put two bands on each of these chicks, and this is part of a Midwest program that's been going on since the 80s that the states and the provinces in the Midwest have been working together to try to reestablish the species. And one of the bands is what we call a federal band. It comes from the federal government. They're all sequentially numbered. They're really hard to read because they have tiny little numbers on them, but that is something that's recorded by the Fish and Wildlife Service that we can look up from wherever the bird gets recovered. The other one is a color band, which is actually got much larger numbers that are much easier to read from a distance. And so we try to keep an eye to find out where our breeding birds coming from. And this has let us understand a little bit more about the populations of birds in the area. So when we see that we've got a bird that's got a color band that tells us it hatched in Ohio or Minnesota or Hamilton, Ontario, we used to have a Hamilton, Ontario bird in Lansing, it lets us know for these birds, going someplace in the neighborhood may not be 5 miles down the road. It may be 500 miles down the road, and they think of that as the local neighborhood. And so it's really helped us understand what the breeding population really looks like for us.
How interesting. We've been talking about Michigan's peregrine falcons. We want to thank Karen Cleveland, a bird biologist for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Be safe out there, Karen. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, Lake Superior magazine editor Connie LeMay takes us on a circle tour of the greatest of the Great Lakes. The natural and man-made beauty of Lake Superior is the subject of an upcoming tour and a new article by Lake Superior magazine editor Connie LeMay. She joins us shortly. That's coming up on Current State. Right after that announcement, I'll just say many thanks to all of you who make it a point to listen to Current State or the Current State podcast, and a reminder that without your financial assistance, it would not be possible. We thank you. As adults, we often talk about setting an example for children to follow, but sometimes the kids are the ones who set the example for us. Epiphany Now, that's Epiphany spelled with a P-I-F, is a Lansing organization dedicated to passing it forward. Its mission is to create a revolution of positive experiences through acts of kindness. Every year, they give awards to youth in the community who are taking initiative and finding new ways to spread kindness to others, and we are going to be bestowing those awards here in the coming minutes. Joining us in the studio to tell us more about Epiphany Now and the YPIF Awards is the organization's founder, Bob Hoffman. Bob, welcome back.
Good morning.
Also joining us are two very recent recipients of the YPIF Award, Skylar Mendez and Rachel Kilmer. Skylar and Rachel, welcome.
Good morning.
Bob, how does Epiphany Now put this mission of spreading kindness into action? How do you make it happen?
You know, we've been doing this since 2009. We gather large groups of people together. We give them 100 different ideas of things they can do. We send them out into the community, and then they come back and share their story. And it's been very popular since 2009. But last year, we decided that we wanted to honor youth that are really doing incredible acts of kindness on their own. And so we developed the YPIF Award. And so last year we gave the first YPIF Award out. And then this year we gave the second YPIF Award out. And we have two of the winners with us today, Rachel and Skylar, because they've done something on their own that really benefits other people. And what we want to do is not only thank them, but encourage more youth to look at them and say, you have the power to make a difference in somebody else's life, no matter where you are, no matter what age you are.
Mm-hmm. And you brought the awards here with you today.
So I brought the awards for the girls today. Skylar and Rachel, there you go. And
thank you.
The girls will also, part of the award was $500 for the winner. So each of the girls will get $500. Plus, they raised some money online on the Epiphany Now website. So they'll get that money towards their charities.
Excellent.
Which is very cool.
Skylar, you're 12 years old. You received a YPIF award for your Suitcases for Kids project. What was the goal of the project?
To make sure that everyone in foster care gets clothing and stuff that belongs to them.
Where'd you get the idea for this?
Well, I started it in sixth grade, and I'm in seventh grade now. But I got it from watching a video of... I forget what it's called.
That's okay.
But it's a video on foster care and how, like, their belongings. And I just saw how some of the foster kids that come into our home don't have as many clothings and everything that they normally have at, like, a regular home.
You have foster kids who live with you?
We do.
Is that it? Okay. How many foster kids have lived with your family?
I think 11, but we have 4 right now.
Wow. Okay. And how will the money here help your project?
Well, I'm working with Samaritas, and that's the place where like all the clothing is donated and everything. And so we're building like shelving units, and we're putting like the money towards more clothing for the project.
It can only help, right?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on getting your award. Bob, tell us a little bit more about why you think Skylar is a worthy recipient.
Yeah, you know, we have a committee that gets together, and Skylar in her application talked about the fact that she had so many foster children come to their home and didn't have a suitcase or any clothing, and she wanted to make sure that they had something when they left. And that really touched our hearts, and we thought that was a really good project. And so we all came together and said that was really it fit our mission, which is passing kindness forward. And we hope that with this award, she's able to not only buy more suitcases, but as she said, build more shelving for that suitcases and fill them with clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a real need there.
I'm speaking with Bob Hoffman, founder of Epiphany Now, and two recipients of Epiphany Now's YPIF Award, Skylar Mendez and Rachel Kilmer. You're a student at St. John's High School. You won a YPIF Award for your volunteer work with the Capital Area Humane Society. What do you do there?
So I'm an education counselor. So I help counsel the summer camps. They're day camps, and all age groups are welcome. I also am a behavior volunteer. So I help train dogs and hopefully make them more adoptable or make them more comfortable in the shelter environment before they go and get adopted.
How do you do that? How do you make a dog that might be kind of out of control, make them a little bit more easier, a little easier for someone to consider adopting?
Yeah, so it depends on the dog. So dogs with a little bit more higher energy, they're kind of like a grown-up puppy. They jump and they mouth, and no one really took the time to teach them their manners. And so we'll take the time and teach them their manners. We'll ignore them when they're jumping. We won't get them out of their kennel until they have all 4 feet on the floor. We'll also teach them to relax on a mat. So they learn to lay down on the mat, and it's great for like when people are coming into the house and you want your dog to like not jump and go crazy when people come into the house. And also,
I am more
like,
familiar with that scenario than you would ever believe.
Yeah.
I've got stories, but I won't bore you with them now. Now, do you have a particular animal you've worked with that stands out in your memory as one for any reason?
Probably Jackson. He was this 75-pound puppy.
75-pound
puppy?
Yeah,
he was a pretty big dog. Mm. He was an adult, but he acted like a puppy. He didn't have any of his manners.
Gotcha.
And it was during canine training, and I just took the whole week training him, and it just seeing his progress, and that was kind of the aha moment of, wow, I like training dogs, and maybe I can do this in the future.
Outstanding. So, Bob, why was Rachel chosen for the award?
You know, the Capillary Humane Society wrote this amazing essay on Rachel, nominating her for the award, and talked about how she dedicates so much of her time to come in and take it upon herself to do this. And not only do other kids look up to her, but other adults look up to her. And she's making a real difference with the organization. And that, to us, made her stand out as a YPIF recipient.
Exemplary adults and exemplary kids.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's amazing. What was your reaction, Rachel, when you found out you won the award?
I was pretty surprised, because going to the Humane Society is I don't really think of it as doing something amazing. I just think of it as like, oh, it's another day to go hang out with some dogs and some children. So I was pretty surprised and also grateful, because Humane Society got $500.
Yeah.
So.
How will the award money help the animals?
So it'll just all go to the shelter and provide them for whatever they need. I don't know specifically. I'm not in the financial area, but all the money goes to help the organization and the animals.
What year are you in at St. John's High School?
I'm a junior, in 11th grade.
Okay, just about ready to become a senior. Is the school year wrapping up in St. John's?
Yeah, thankfully it is. Okay. Almost done.
Is there a question for all of you here, for our listeners who may be feeling inspired and want to get involved? Skylar, how does Suitcases for Kids need help? What could they use?
They can go to Samaritas Monday through Friday, and they can donate from 9 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is in Holt. They can go and donate any of their gently used clothing, suitcases, or anything.
Really. Rachel, is there a need for volunteers at the Humane Society?
Oh, absolutely. We love having volunteers. There's always stuff to get done. There's always stuff to do. You can hang out with some dogs and some cats, or you can do the nitty-gritty work, like doing dishes and laundry, or just, you don't have to. It's fine.
Bob, Epiphany Now seems to be thriving several years after you launched this.
It's kind of funny, because we started it and thought, okay, we'll do it a couple of times and that'll be it. And every year it just continues to grow. And now with the YPIF, we really hope it grows. Our future mission is to really grow the YPIF larger, so it's an example. So more kids are wanting to get involved to get that award, to create projects on their own that are really transforming our society, because it starts with them. And you know, Epiphany Now, a lot of people, we got flack saying, oh, this is boastful. Well, it's not boastful. It's teaching people the power of kindness, and teaching kids especially that you can make a difference. You can do something today that makes a difference. It doesn't have to be grand. It could be something small, but you have the power to do that no matter where you are.
And a lot of times I think it ends up changing the perspective of the person doing the giving. I mean, you're ostensibly you're helping somebody else, But it helps the person doing the giving a lot of times.
That's exactly right.
I think. When you hold a typical event then, Bob, how does it work?
So we hold an event. People come in. They register. We give them cards that say pass it forward on it, Epiphany Now. And we ask them to give those cards out when they're doing the act of kindness and ask them to pass it forward, pass it on. Now, you know, there's similar organizations that have been doing this forever. I mean, Pass It Forward has been along for a long time. What makes us unique is that we gather the groups together at the Michigan State University Federal Credit Union on the first Sunday of every May. We do this. And so we gather the groups together, we go out, disperse, and then we come back an hour and a half later and you share those stories of what you did. And the power in the energy in the room is like a magnetism. I mean, it's incredible. You hear the things that people do to
make
a difference.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Bob Hoffman, founder of Epiphany Now, and two recipients of Epiphany Now's YPIF Awards, Skylar Mendez and Rachel Kilmer. Bob, Rachel, Skylar, thank you for being here.
Yeah,
continued good work.
Thank you.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Email us your suggestions. currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. To call Connie LeMay one of Lake Superior's biggest boosters is an understatement. The Duluth, Minnesota native was raised on the shores of the greatest lake. LeMay is editor of Lake Superior Magazine, the monthly publication of regional travel, food, nature, and history. Later this year, Connie will take the classic circle tour of Lake Superior, dropping into numerous natural and man-made destinations. LeMay's recent magazine article, The Circle in Pictures, celebrates the vivid landscape photography of John Hino and John Kay while serving as a preview to her journey. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Connie LeMay earlier this week about places like Wemet Canyon and Aguasaban Falls, two scenes from Superior's wild beauty.
As you can see from the photos, absolutely spectacular, right. Landscapes. The thing about Wemet Canyon that's particularly intriguing is that, and they don't allow tours down to the bottom of the canyon, but you can walk around the top and be able to see it. But at the bottom of the canyon are Arctic plants. It's because of, I think, the depth of the canyon itself, which is nearly 330 feet down. It's cool enough, even during the summer, that Arctic plants are able to grow. So it's probably the farthest south you would ever see those kinds of plants.
The farthest south you'd see these Arctic plants, and yet the spectacular landscape there at Wemet Canyon Park is almost Grand Canyon-like in appearance.
Well, of course, it's the old Canadian Shield formations. You've got the wonderful rock canyon sides that are, it really is a spectacular area as well.
And Aguasaban Falls and Terrace Bay, as you said, the photography here in the Circle in Pictures article is spectacular with this incredible fall and then a racing river down at the bottom, and the landscape is just incredibly wild with the mountains in the background too.
Yes, and the other thing about it is that while you're getting this very wilderness view, there's a nice boardwalk to the overlook, so it's more accessible than having to hike through a lot of rough areas. So there are trails there that if you want to take a little more of adventure, you certainly can. But at the same time, a lot of these spectacular sites around the Circle Tour are accessible close to completely accessible or else fairly easy hikes, depending on your abilities. The other thing, if you're looking at that particular spread, next to that, the double falls, and Aguasaban Falls has two falls kind of, together that you can see. But you'll notice the wonderful cobblestone beach,
oh,
which
yeah.
is also right in next to Terrace Bay. So these two, both of these two entities are near Terrace Bay, which is toward the top of Lake Superior. Nipigon is the absolute north, point north on Lake Superior, and that has a brand new park called Paddle to the Sea Park that the city put together. And for people who know the book Paddle to the Sea, which is about a little native boy who puts a carved canoe into a little Indian figure into the water at Lake Nipigon, and it travels all the way to France in the children's book through Lake Superior. So Paddle to the Sea, and Nipigon is Lake Nipigon is one of the tributaries into the Nipigon River into Lake Superior. So it's all about traversing Lake Superior and all of the Great Lakes, actually. So they have a nice little theme park called Paddle to the Sea based on that children's book.
North of Lake Superior, in the Nipigon country. That's where Paddle was born one winter, in a little cabin deep in the woods. Now, that cabin was not only far away from the sea, it was also far above the level of the sea. And that's why the boy who lived there got a cedar log from the woods and started to carve Paddle to the Sea.
Then the next place, if you're going to see another familiar children's character, is White River, Ontario, where they have a statue to Winnie the Pooh. And the reason they have a statue there is because the actual bear, Winnipeg, was purchased by a British soldier in Canada and brought to England. And then he eventually gave the cub to the London Zoo. And A.A. Milne, who wrote the Winnie the Pooh books, took his son there. They used to love watching Winnipeg, the bear cub, and eventually the bear, and that's what he based his Winnie the Pooh books on. So there's a nice little statue there to Winnie the Pooh, and they have a festival every year celebrating Winnie the Pooh.
Some of the stories and sights from the circle tour around Lake Superior. And speaking with Connie LeMay, editor of Lake Superior magazine, we're talking about some of the iconic stories and sights around that tour. You mentioned a couple of those stories. A couple of the sights that are so iconic are those lighthouses. We see two of those from Michigan. The Point Iroquois Lighthouse, and then also the Apostle Islands National Lighthouse. Love that one with the circular lighthouse and then the beautiful lighthouse keeper's house just below that, both in that beautiful whitewash.
Yes, yeah, and Lake Superior actually has 32 or 34 lighthouses around the lake, many of them accessible by land. The Michigan Island lighthouse that you described there, the whitewashed circular tower, is on Michigan Island, but there are some great cruise tours of the Apostle Islands, and there are 7 or 8 lighthouses on the islands there. There are 22 islands in the Apostles, 21 of which are a part of the National Lakeshore, and one, Madeline Island, is the only island on Lake Superior that has a year-round population on it. And so that's a Wisconsin area, but another gorgeous place to spend time. The Point Iroquois, like in Michigan, and Michigan has many wonderful lighthouses, too. Michigan is called the shipwreck coast of Lake Superior because the section of Michigan from the Sioux Locks over past the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore was one of the main areas that ships would go down. It also happens to be the area where the Edmund Fitzgerald in Canadian waters went down. So it is a dangerous but a beautiful coast, and the Point Iroquois Light is in that area.
We are now on the shore of Lake Superior, the largest of the Great Lakes, in a region that is noted for its tourist allure. Among the many tributaries of Lake Superior is the Tequamenon River, which flows through the land that inspired Henry Wadsworth Longfellow to write his immortal story of Hiawatha.
Connie LeMay, editor of Lake Superior Magazine, talking about a bit of the circle tour around Lake Superior that she'll be taking a little bit later on this year. Connie, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. I hope people do consider doing a circle tour or even just one day, one place is a good idea.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
And it is here that we now conclude our roaming in Michigan.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we will talk with East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows about the budget for the city for the coming fiscal year, also plans to demolish the long vacant property at Grand River in Abbott, and the Capital Area Transportation Authority's plan for a bus rapid transit system through East Lansing. Plus, we'll meet the new director of the MSU Broad Art Museum, Mark Olivier Waller, before he officially takes that position in July. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Get it anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.